Welcome to the Health Connective Show. I'm your host, Michael Roberts. Today, we're talking to Scott Nelson. Scott is the founder of MedCider and co-founder of Fastwave Medical. A lot of Scott's work focuses on sharing insights with early stage medical device companies and med tech companies, and then showing them how they can leverage lessons from successful med tech entrepreneurs for their own businesses. Scott, welcome to the show. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Michael. Really looking forward to an engaging discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that as we were preparing for the show, we saw that MedCider does really well is create playbooks for startup med tech companies that compile advice on how to approach different business problems and challenges. One of the things that we found in there was about achieving that right product market fit, which obviously your guests have experiences with, and obviously you have experience with. So definitely wanted to kind of pick your brain on how that topic comes up, because it keeps coming up as other companies are trying to figure this out and trying to go to market. So it's an obvious question, but people are still doing it wrong. So this is still worth asking. You know, why is it so important for medtech companies to find that product market fit early on?
It's a bit of a kind of, to your point, Michael, like an obvious kind of topic to discuss, but I think some people sort of tend to gloss over it, right? But I think it's especially important to try to answer as early as possible in our space, in medtech, particularly because it's such a long way to get to eventual commercialization. And there's so many inflection points and milestones along that way that you really need to ensure that you've got what I kind of call product market fit signals early on and continuously, right, throughout that development and kind of clinical reg pathway to ensure that, like, when it comes time to launch, there is going to be traction, right? Your whatever solution you're building, whatever device you're working on, et cetera, there's going to be some stickiness, right? It's going to resonate with your end users. So it's, I think generally speaking, product market fit. In fact, when you look at kind of the three pillars, product market team, I'm just a funnel, you know, people could argue this a number of different ways. I'm kind of a fundamental believer that, that market is most important because of just the significant amount of resources, time, and capital that's typically thrown at a device project, looking for those signals and finding them as early as possible to prevent unneeded or sort of throwing too many dollars and too much time, really, which arguably is more important at a particular project, is really, 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 really important.
So you're talking about, and this is one of the things we want to ask about, so product or market. And you're leaning more heavily into market. So let's say you pick the market you want to go after. You're looking at them and then just trying to come up with a product idea there. Is that how you like to approach it? Because I know we've definitely come across other products where, man, here's a couple of brilliant engineers working on something and they came up with this cool thing. Wouldn't it be cool if we could use it somewhere, and then they struggle to find any kind of place. So definitely interested in hearing how you think about that.
I think that's where a lot of us, especially those that are biased more towards the world, the entrepreneurial ecosystem, is it starts there, right? It's like you see a really cool idea, or maybe you can't sleep one night because you constantly think about this one thing that needs to be built or needs to be created. And it's so easy to get stuck on that idea, I think, for all of us, right? Especially if it's our own kind of cool widget or solution that we thought of. But a huge mistake that I think all of us need to consider early on is, especially in med tech, when so many of these projects are going to require additional capital, right? Whether it's venture capital, whether it's, you know, even early on money from angels and high net worth individuals, is this idea fundable? You know, can it be backed by outside capital? And really kind of what ladders into sort of answering that question is what is the market like, right? This could be an amazing idea that solves a very real need, right? That should be addressed. But they're kind of the cold reality in med tech, because of kind of the regulatory burden, the clinical burden, is you're going to need, likely going to need capital. And so what you want to avoid is a scenario where you go all in on an idea and work on it for 2 years, maybe even throw a lot of your own money at it. And then at the end of the day, it's just not something that's going to be supported by outside, you know, investors. And in that scenario, you've got very limited options, right? You could continue to try to find money, and that's it. Ultimately where you spend all your time is just trying to find money to support the project, or you shut it down and pursue a different concept. So I think trying to answer that key question up front is this, you know, can this be fundable, right? Is this an idea that can be supported by outside capital? And again, one of the easy answers to that question is how big is the market, right? Is this a massive market, both kind of at a TAM level and at a SAM level? And, you know, even if you have a really phenomenal team working on an awesome product that serves a very small market, it's going to be a tough road to haul, right? And, you know, kind of vice versa. If you have an awesome product, you know, and a subpar team, but the market's still small, you know, you kind of end up in the same scenario. Where if you got maybe the semblance of a product, right, and the semblance of a team, but it's a massive market, you know, and your thing, whatever you're working on, even though that it's not totally refined, but it solves a real painkiller, right? A painkiller type of need. That's the, those are the types of projects early on that we should be leaning into, right? Massive market. And there's like a real like pain here that isn't resolved or isn't currently being served.
Yeah. So I want to dig into your experience a little bit on this, because I know that you've got the podcast that you do, you've got MedCider, and you're talking to a lot of other founders that are in this kind of place. You've founded now, co-founded a couple of different companies. So there's definitely the experience that you have there. I guess, are you doing much like advising to other startups? Like, how does that kind of enter in day to day when you, I guess you're kind of talking to shop to other people in the same situation that you're in?
I'm involved with a couple other startups besides Fastwave, but none of which require a significant amount of time. I sit on the boards of a few different companies, but you know, Fastwave is my primary focus, has been for, you know, the better part of 3 years now. And as you mentioned, I have the kind of unique opportunity of having a podcast that's been around for quite some time. I consider myself a bit of an OG in the podcasting world, where, you know, I started back in, I think, 2009, 2010 timeframe, and you know, we're almost 15 years in now. You know, the grays in my sideburns are kind of coming through. But I do have a unique opportunity to kind of talk to a lot of people. And that's where I, you know, shows like this, I primarily kind of focus on interviewing, you know, founders and CEOs of, you know, seed to Series C startups. You know, that's kind of my focus anyway. Not that I exclude, you know, others that maybe don't fit that particular kind of criteria, but it has gotten a unique opportunity to talk with a lot of people, right, that are working on their ventures, their startups at various stages. And so it's definitely selfishly been very beneficial for me, from not only a networking perspective, but also it's an amazing learning opportunity as well. And so a lot of my thinking, right, around this particular topic, product market fit, is rooted in, and not necessarily reading a really good book or reading a, you know, a piece from, you know, HBR or something like that. It's actually talking to people who are building, right? Which I'm much more biased towards, right? People that are in the trenches building, they're, you know, in most cases going to have a lot more tangible kind of real valuable feedback to offer up versus, you know, reading a white paper somewhere.
You've done this podcast for 15 years now. Looking back, how many of them made it? How many of them are still doing their thing? How many of them have pivoted successfully? Like, what does that story kind of look like in terms of like all these people you are getting to meet? Are you seeing them go on to bigger and better things? Or are you seeing them miss some things that they should have like considered earlier on? Or like, how's that playing out?
That's a good question. I never really tried to quantify that per se. And really, you know, even to kind of go back into the early days of MedCider, my focus hasn't always been on having discussions with kind of founders and CEOs of the, you know, C to Series C startups. I would say probably over the past handful of years, I've kind of narrowed in on that focus specifically. But because a lot of the founders and CEOs that I talk to have already raised a fair amount of capital, I think that does definitely position them a little bit better, right, than someone who's, you know, just got out of the starting blocks and maybe has, you know, been awarded maybe some non-dilutive funding through a grant or maybe raised some pre-seed capital. Not to say that those folks can't make it, but they're definitely in the early stages. And once you get some investment support from, you know, institutional capital, it definitely positions you better, but you're never out of the weeds. And what's amazing, Michael, and that's always sort of stood out to me, is that I'll have serial entrepreneurs on, right, that have had a really significant exit, right? Maybe a couple under their belt. And it's like, wow, I mean, they've made it, right? If whatever venture they're going to work on next, easily fundable, they'll get all the best, you know, VCs behind them, et cetera. And that's not the case whatsoever. In fact, I recently had Steve Anderson on the program. I haven't published it yet. Maybe by this time, that time this is live, it'll be on the site. But he's the founder of, he's an electrophysiologist by background. He's the founder of Farapulse, which Boston Scientific recently received approval from FDA on. It's kind of a big thing in the cardiovascular space. And, you know, he's the founder of that company. And we're talking about, oh, you know, Farapulse is getting a ton of buzz now. He's on to his next venture. Oh, it just must be super easy, right, to raise capital. And he just wrapped up, I think, a Series A, I believe. Don't quote me on that. It might have been a seed round. I can't remember exactly. And he, you know, his comment was, yeah, maybe slightly easier, right? But no, I mean, he's still having to grind and pitch a lot of people and convince a lot of stakeholders that this is the next big thing, that they should get behind it. And so that process of, you know, raising capital and convincing stakeholders, it never ends, right? I mean, it's something that I'm a big believer in, this acronym of always be capitalizing, right? I'll steal it from a buddy of mine, Sean Morris, who's kind of a serial entrepreneur, but it's very true for any kind of, you know, either founder, CEO, or really kind of leadership team in a startup, is that everyone sort of always needs to be having that mindset, right? Keeping capital money in the bank is probably you know, thing number one in order to transition your startup from kind of default dead to default alive. That's one of the things that stood out to me, you know, over the years, you know, talking to a lot of really, really experienced folks that, you know, have a lot more years and wisdom kind of under their belt.
That's an awesome training course that you're getting sort of day in, day out. And let's talk about FastWave. I mean, this isn't just theory. This is very real life, and you're getting a chance to practice it. So kind of walk us through, I guess, like how you looked at market fit when it came to FastWave.
It's a really good question. I think it ties into kind of what we were chatting about earlier, is really a focus on market. So circa, you know, mid 2020, kind of rewinding the clock, you know, 3.5 years ago or so, as a founding team, we were looking at a wide variety of markets, right, or to potential projects to work on. And one of them that kept surfacing was intravascular lithotripsy, or IVL. And it's this is a relatively new kind of category within the cardiovascular space. It was created by really the only incumbent in the market, which is a company called Shockwave Medical. And they were publicly traded at the time, back in kind of mid 2020, but they really hadn't taken off yet. And we were kind of following what they had been working on as a company, and had this kind of fundamental belief that technology would, like, the utilization of that technology, I should say, would fundamentally increase over time. That SAM, which is, you know, the TAM in the cardiovascular space for coronary disease is quite large, but the SAM for IVL would increase. And then secondarily, we were tracking the progress of a company called CSI, or Cardiovascular Systems, which recently exited to Abbott maybe a year ago or so. And they had initiated something called an intra-parties review process to invalidate Shockwave's key patents. And so we've kind of been tracking that over a couple of years. And when the USPTO overwhelmingly ruled in favor of CSI in mid-2020, we thought that was kind of the why now moment, which I think most startups have, is like some sort of inflection point, some sort of time period where it's like, we should double down on this. We should really kind of pour more of our own time and resources at this particular project. And that was it for us, right? So it was kind of a combination of two things, but really the overall market, right? And the belief that the utilization of IVL would continue to increase. That was sort of the underlying kind of belief that we had. And it, you know, it's turned out to be quite true. But I think what's most important, even in our case, is that we weren't necessarily married to it, right? We began to kind of slowly prototype. And then when Shockwave received their PMA, their coronary PMA in early 21, that's when the company really started taking off, right? But if they hadn't, right, we may have thought a little bit differently about the project and how we were approaching it. So, you know, the main lesson there is you've got to be nimble and flexible. And again, not married to either a particular idea or even a particular market, right? Because if things change, which they often do, you've got to be willing to kind of let things go and pivot if necessary.
With FastWave Medical, from the start, were you already thinking like, hey, we're definitely going to be in the cardiovascular space? And so you had some like medical people already on staff or like kind of plotting with you that were thinking through like, this is how we're going to tackle cardiovascular? Or was it sort of this like wide open book of like, we can kind of pick any direction and then we'll figure out how to bring in the right doctor and the right medical staff as we get further along?
Broadly speaking, we're like as kind of a founding group, because it's certainly not just me, but kind of our founding team that was involved with FastWave. Most of our domain expertise is within the cardiovascular space, but that space is quite large, right? It includes structural heart. You could kind of, you know, potentially even throw like neurovascular kind of in that broader kind of vascular kind of bucket, if you will. You got peripheral vascular, you know, coronary applications, etc. So it's quite broad. So we were looking at a number of different projects kind of in that early to mid 2020 timeframe. And actually one other company that's venture supported as well is in the venous space. That was a project that we not necessarily deprioritized per se, but, you know, sort of, right? Kind of deprioritized because of this kind of underlying belief in the momentum around IVL that we had at the time. It's important to consider that idea of being flexible, right? And not being married to any particular space. And, you know, another category that we were looking at quite hard is thrombectomy. That was at that point in time, there's a lot of startups working on thrombectomy devices. There still is, as an example, but decided not to pursue that with more rigor and prioritized IVL, right? Because of, again, the underlying belief that the utilization of the therapy would increase. And then again, there wasn't a lot of other startups at the time that we knew of that were working on IVL. There's very few. And so that also presented kind of a unique opportunity for us to, you know, if we could make progress and get the company funded, we thought there would be a good kind of shot on goal here.
Very nice. Very nice. So this kind of segues nice, because we're kind of talking about sort of like how you're feeling about things and sort of what you're seeing the market do and sort of like what are these opportunities. At what point and how extensively can data really drive your decision making as you're trying to get down that product development pathway, not just picking the product, but like and this is how we're going to kind of pursue this pathway.
I have a love-hate relationship with data. I definitely don't think, I mean, you need to definitely quantify, you know, some decisions. There's no doubt. Whether it's sizing a market, right? Whether it's substantiating a value on your startup during a fundraise, whether it's looking at even clinical efficacy around a particular therapy, there's no doubt, right? I mean, you want to lean on data, but I think the mistake that I've made, maybe that others have made in the past, is relying on it too much. I recall a conversation I had with Dr. Christian Ramdo, the founder and CEO of Tempa Health, and they make great strides in Europe, and I think they're now in the process of coming into the U.S. with their technology. And one of the things that he mentioned that really stood out to me is that. And this is he's very, very intellectual, very, very thoughtful kind of entrepreneur. And he was like, early on when they were in the process of gathering a lot of data, right? Whether it's, you know, qualitative kind of VOC or just kind of quantifiable data from a market analysis, he said, you can make the mistake of just, you know, going too far and wide and not being able to kind of filter down and remove the noise. And I think that really stood out to me because that's where we can sometimes let data overrule kind of natural intuition, right? And sort of gut feeling based on what we know and what we hear and see kind of being in the trenches. And so kind of just like most things, I think there needs to be a balance. But that would be the one kind of thing that I'd like to kind of emphasize is, yes, you need to quantify certain things, but don't let that be the only single driver, right, for all of your decision making.
It's interesting, like right before we hit record today, like we were talking through, I was trying out some different projects where I was trying some different messaging testing and all this kind of stuff and just saw things just nosedive and did not hit the way that I wanted to and all of that kind of stuff. What was interesting about that process, and I think, and I've heard this sort of like from a sort of like data analysis process on a lot of different levels now is, there were AI tools to summarize all the feedback that I got and gave me like some like four or five kind of key bullet points. And you're talking about this sort of like overwhelm that we can fall into, because I had this massive spreadsheet and I was trying to go through line by line and you know, and you're too close to the project at the first anyway. So you're kind of like a little emotional about how you're perceiving the data. And then just trying to get down to like, okay, what do I do with all this? How do I actually take something out of this and move forward? So yeah, it's definitely an issue. Let's switch gears a little bit. So, you know, we're talking about like you're getting some information back from your customers. Sometimes that information isn't always flattering. It's not always what you hope it will be. And very popular in the startup world is this concept of minimal viable product, right? Like, hey, we'll just get it out there. Let's move fast. Let's break things. Let's, you know, all those fun like startup phrases. But this is medical. It's not the same thing. So, you know, how does that affect your market positioning if you do kind of take that too minimal approach?
Just real quick, as you were kind of sort of adding some context, right, to this data topic, right, before we jump to MVP, because I think it's very, I want to definitely touch on this MVP topic because I think it's super relevant. And most people, I think a lot of people in med tech don't think it's applicable, but I do think it is actually. One of the recent conversations I had with Ken Mariash, I believe, I'm going to mispronounce his last name, but he's the CEO of Synaptica, really, really impressive CEO. And we were talking about this idea of data, largely around kind of the context of market data. And this is, you know, I think he spent most of his career in, you know, kind of on both sides of the table. He's, you know, as an investor or on the BD side at Strategics. And, you know, we were kind of riffing on this topic of like, you allocate a lot of budget towards this really impressive market analysis that's substantiated by really phenomenal data. It's super impressive. You read through it. And it took maybe 3-4 months. And we were joking around this idea of like, you could have just gone and talked to like 3 sales reps and got the same end result, you know, reps that are like in the field, in the trenches, deep with their, you know, whether they're physician stakeholders or other clinical stakeholders, et cetera. And I think, again, that sort of reminds me of this idea of don't let data just, you know, don't let data be just the ultimate driver, right? Use it as a lever for sure. And to maybe help directionally or kind of like help you directionally. But again, a lot of times learn a lot more just by kind of being in the trenches with your customers. And it's going to be kind of, you know, that's going to ladder up to kind of qualitative kind of intuition. But with that said, kind of this topic of MVP, I think it's a good one, right? Because again, there's a lot of cliches. You watch a movie. What was the movie on Facebook? Was it Social? The Social?
Yeah, Social Network.
Social Network. Yeah. Or even BlackBerry, right? The recent BlackBerry movie, which is kind of funny too. Yeah, like move, you know, you move fast and break things. And it's like you do that in med tech and your startup's going to be dead quite quickly. So I do fundamentally believe that first impressions matter. for sure. If you launch a device, in fact, I was having this conversation with another cardiovascular start, the CEO of another cardiovascular startup that's done quite well. I won't mention his name, but we were talking about this idea of like their first iteration they launched with really set the company back because it wasn't great. It wasn't a great, and they launched with it. And they just had a kind of, it took a while to sort of, you know, not only go back to the drawing board, but kind of overcome a lot of the skepticism, right, that a lot of users had with their second generation version. So I do think it's important. I think where it's really applicable to medtech startups is kind of thinking about the various stages that we all go through, right? From initial kind of concept to prototype to maybe an alpha version to a beta version, and even into, you know, potential clinical studies, is thinking about the minimum viable thing, right? So like, what's the minimum viable alpha that we can create that is going to demonstrate the one or two things that we really need to prove with alpha? Right. So as an example, I don't want to layer in a bunch of features that are going to be in our commercial product into the alpha version. Right. I want the most minimal viable kind of alpha version that's focused on those key things that we need to prove out with this particular iteration. Same thing applies with beta. And the same concept holds true even as you get into like, you know, pilot feasibility studies, is what's the minimum viable thing that's safe, right? That doesn't break the rules, that we can effectively use in a patient to demonstrate safety and maybe performance, right, as well. So again, thinking about kind of that aspect of the minimum viable thing as you kind of move through the various stages that most med tech startups have to move through, I think that's what's most important to think about with respect to kind of this MVP topic.
We had a chance to talk to the team from BoldType. They do a lot of product development, helping companies like kind of figure all this stuff out, right? And one of the big challenges that they talked about is sort of that wish list of things that people want to have in their product by the time it goes to market. And it's like, yes, eventually we can include all of those things you just listed off. Do you want to go to market this year, or are you looking like 3 years out? Because like, we can eventually get all those things in, but you may be making your life a whole lot harder and taking a whole lot more time to actually get there.
No doubt. I remember Dr. Scott Wolf telling me, he's the founder of Cool Sculpting, which I think a lot of people are aware of. He's now, his most recent startup is Aaron Medical. They're doing quite well in the ENT space. And I think he might even be onto another thing by now. But, you know, a guy that's done a lot, experienced a lot of things, kind of a mensch in our space. And we were talking about their early clinical studies with Aaron. And he was like, no, we were lugging around this big, ugly looking box. It was super heavy, not portable. But it served what we needed for those initial clinical studies, which was most important, right? They just needed to get to that inflection point, get this in patients in a safe way that, you know, proved out certain points that they were kind of focused on. And again, that's coming from, you know, someone that's been around and experienced a lot. And he was totally comfortable with that approach, right? Because a lot of us might be embarrassed. We're going to take this big, ugly thing into a clinic and we're going to get looks of like, is that really even safe? Does that even work? But so long as it does, right, and you've done the necessary kind of bench testing or maybe even preclinical testing that's needed for those first human studies, that's sort of like, is a good example of what we're talking about here, like getting to that, you know, just minimally viable enough to prove out what you need at that particular stage.
So let's shift gears a bit. And I'm doing a lot of shifting gears on you. I appreciate you staying with me through all this. The whole concept, entirely novel solution or iterating on what's out there already, what's better? What makes sense for companies? What are all the caveats that go in such a broad question like that? I'm sure there are definitely benefits to both, but what do you think, Ronald?
Yeah, man, this is a good topic. And I hate to sound cliche, and it's like an answer like it depends. It depends largely on who you're talking to, right? So like as an example, if you're talking to a VC, right, they're in most cases trying to like make very significant bets, outsized bets that are going to return their entire fund or a multiple of their entire fund. And they're likely not going to be okay with just a me better version, right? They're going to want something very differentiated, very novel. Whereas if you talk to a physician that's used to using a certain device and they're just looking for some improvements, right? Like they just need it to do X, Y, and Z, and the current kind of company is not doing that, right? The current company doesn't want to innovate. They just need it to do a little bit better. That's kind of your classic me better, right? Your version two. And so a lot of times folks in marketing, product development, even R&D for that matter, we'll get too lost in trying to develop something super differentiated and super novel when that's really not necessarily what your end users are looking for. So of course it's a balance and it probably depends on kind of where you're at as a company. But at the end of the day, I would just really ensure that, or really be mindful of, even if your novel idea is really cool, right? And could really like be incredibly beneficial. If it's going to create a lot of friction with the end user, that's likely going to affect adoption to a very, very large degree. Even if it's a really cool solution, if it's hard from a workflow perspective, if it's creating five extra steps in the process, just be mindful of that, right? As you kind of balance, something super novel versus something that's just an iterative improvement.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of skepticism that comes from buying committees as well for hospitals that are thinking about taking that big leap and leaning into something that's so very different. Mm-hmm. Just to give a shout out to a community that I'm a part of as an orthopedic group, that they're talking through a lot of like new products and sort of like all the pain points that you kind of just described there. It's called Bone Chat. A guy named Tiger Buford runs it. And they talk about like, hey, if you're deviating from what's out there, you're definitely facing an uphill battle, right? Like there's definitely a big challenge there. Another, trade show that we were at this past year, there was kind of a panel of different companies that were kind of all in the same space, right? And there was a clear incumbent in the space that had presented earlier. And then there was a several, that were kind of like talking about why they each deserved a share of the market. And they each had like interesting things to bring to the table. And then it was funny because there was somebody there that was also like from an ASC group, and all the startups are trying to get in front of the ASCs, and like, because that's the big pivot, that's where everything's going and all this kind of stuff. And they were all saying like, this is why, why we deserve a share, why people should consider us. And we don't want to be a clone. Like that's the big evil. Don't be a clone of what already exists. And because then you're just in a race to the bottom on pricing. And the guy from the ASC was like, look, he's responsible for all the purchasing and stuff. He's like, I'd be happy with a clone. If I could get a cheaper version of the thing that's already out there, I'd be fine with that.
Yeah.
May not be the market leader, but I'm okay with that. So
no, it's a really great point. I mean, all of us, that are listening, or at least probably a very healthy percentage, go to Costco on a regular basis, right? I mean, look at the Kirkland brand. That is your classic, like maybe either clone, maybe slightly better, maybe slightly not better, but it's a phenomenal price. You know what I mean? And so yeah, I mean that can absolutely be a value driver, right? Is making sure that or working on something that has a significant economic advantage. There's other sort of things to consider, right? Your supply chain, et cetera, that can help you kind of hold sort of margins, right, where they need to be while delivering on a lower price in this example. But and that's such a great example. It's so easy, especially with kind of traditional kind of med tech purists that are always thinking the next novel thing, the next breakthrough thing. And it's like, oftentimes, like your stakeholders, they're just looking for a something just as good that's more economical. I actually think this topic, the economics of devices. I mean, this has been trending in this direction for quite some time, but going to be ever more important, over the next, 5, 10, 20 years.
Yeah. It sounds like hospitals have had like a great run financially here lately. So they're certainly interested in looking what their options are.
Oh, yeah.
One last question for you here. As med tech companies, if they're struggling to find that right market fit, if they're really trying to get this product out there, but they're having a hard time, where do they start? Like they've already got a product. They're realizing that they're having this struggle now. Like where do you try to point people first, or is it a case by case kind of scenario?
It's certainly case by case, right? But the one, as I thought about this question a little bit, the one thing that comes to mind is just the decision around that, right? Because that scenario, right, where you either have launched something that is not getting the traction that you thought it would, or maybe it's still in clinical studies. Maybe you've already allocated a significant R&D budget towards it, but there's this trend of signals, right, that point that this thing's maybe not going to work out, or it's likely not going to work out. I think the decision is probably what's most important around this topic, because if you have to kill it, if you have to kill this project, it's going to be a really, really hard decision. But that's sort of part of the game, right? And maybe I'm speaking to a little bit more of like a startup kind of entrepreneurs. You have to be like really, really comfortable making decisions in an uncomfortable environment, right? Or with imperfect information. One of the guys that I kind of inspires me kind of in the startup ecosystem is Dharmesh Shah, founder of HubSpot. I've heard him mention this several times, that like the best CEOs that he's around kind of in the startup ecosystem, regardless of the vertical, are decision machines. Meaning they're exceptionally good at making quick, decisive decisions when all the information isn't perfect or it's not all there. And sometimes they're going to get it wrong, right? But more often than not, that just the sheer momentum, I should say that the ability to decisively make a decision and the momentum that comes with that is what's most important. So I guess that's kind of where my head goes when we talk about this topic of like, how do you deal with that? Just being cognizant of that, most of the time, the decision is not going to be easy. And what's worst is continuing to allocate time and budget towards something that's never going to have legs, that's never going to have traction. That's the worst, right? Far worse than kind of, you know, making a decision to potentially kill a project. So I don't know if that's helpful, but that's kind of what resonates with me when we talk about kind of this really, really difficult decision around, you know, how to either iterate on a product or just, you know, kill it entirely.
One of the kind of overarching trends, I think, just in my day-to-day right now that I'm considering through all this kind of stuff is like, man, AI is coming so fast and it's going to replace a lot of people and it's going to do this. And there's all these like dire predictions of what's possible. But what are those uniquely human things that we can lean into more, that we can be more of, that we can really kind of seize decisive movements, leading people, leading a company? I think that's a great point, and a great point to wrap up on. Because you can run projections all day long, but it's not going to be the same thing as like making that hard decision and moving forward.
Oh yeah, no doubt. This is a little bit off topic, but since you brought up AI, you know, one thing that I was having a conversation recently with a pretty experienced kind of leader in med tech is now with kind of interesting organization that I would say mostly does investments, if you will. But he mentioned, he's like, Scott, I'm seeing so many pitches these days that where they're really trying to work in this concept of AI. And it just it's like so confusing. It's like, what are you guys even doing? Like, whatever you're working on is definitely not going to like connect with your end users, even if you're saying it's AI, you know what I mean? And so I think that's just something important, right? To your point is like, you know, yes, there's definitely a trend where AI will be increasingly more useful. It's not going to take over the world. You know what I mean? It's just not the case.
Buzzwords are fun when it comes to investing and discussions around all that. That's funny.
So much that I bought fastwavemedical.ai, right? Because I just want to be an AI company.
I was listening to a marketing presentation last week, and the guy said, he's like, I'm pretty sure that I'm the only marketer on LinkedIn that isn't an AI expert, you know, according to my little title there. So,
oh, yeah.
That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, I was listening to the All In podcast. I know this is probably a couple months ago, and David Friedberg, if I remember correctly, right? Who's like, if anyone's knowledgeable about AI, I mean, like he can talk shop. There's no doubt about that. And he was like, he made a comment. He's like, I don't even know how we're describing AI these days. I mean, it's really just like data analysis or machine learning. I mean, it's just like you're taking a subset of data and analyzing it maybe a little bit better. Is that what we're calling AI? You know what I mean? So, again, I think it's kind of, there's no doubt. I mean, like anyone that's used ChatGPT or any of the other tools built on ChatGPT or Bard or any of the other LLMs, it's impressive, no doubt, right? And there's ways to use it, but it's not, there's still a long way to go with the technology for sure.
Definitely. Very awesome. Well, Scott, thank you so much for this conversation today. This has just been definitely a pleasure. It's fun to talk through these ideas, of course, with just like, hey, here's what best practices are, but it's also great to just hear like, hey, and here's what worked and didn't work for us. And here's how we're seeing things actually play out in real life, you know, so it's not just theory. So thank you everybody for listening today. For more on Health Connective Show, please visit hc.show for previous episodes and Health Connective as a company. Thanks so much, everybody.